From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. More Phantoms of the Theater. An American president walks the boards. Haunted theaters in America are few and far between, probably because most don't have much antiquity. One, however, is a center of a classic American ghost story. Ford's Theater in Washington is little more than 100 years old. Today it is best known for being the location of Abraham Lincoln's assassination on April 14, 1865, by an unsuccessful actor from a famous theatrical family, John Wilkes Booth. The story has been often told, but basically it can be said that the assassin broke into the theater's presidential box and emptied his Derringer pistol into Lincoln's head. Booth made his escape by leaping over the rim of the box and onto the stage. Running diagonally across the stage, the fanatical actor fled into the street. He was shot to death in the subsequent pursuit on April 26 in a burning barn on a farm near Port Royal, Virginia. Time and the delving of journalists and occult researchers have produced a haunting theory concerning Ford's Theater. To understand it, however, a look into Abraham Lincoln's own attitude towards ghosts is worthwhile. Perhaps President Abraham Lincoln is the best-known spiritualist ever to occupy the White House. A short while after he became the 16th President of the United States, the Cleveland Plains Dealer published a feature story stating that Lincoln believed in ghosts and was keenly interested in psychic studies. The article was shown to Lincoln and he commented, "This article does not begin to tell the wonderful things I have witnessed. Half of it has not been told." It is not surprising, therefore, that Lincoln's assassination has a psychic aura about it. The story of President Lincoln's own trance dream of his assassination is well known. Gideon Wells, one of the members of Lincoln's cabinet, left this recollection of what the president had himself said. "President Lincoln said that his dream was focused on water and that he was sailing in a singular but indescribable vessel. In it, he seemed to float towards a shore he knew was ultimate death. This dream had occurred to him before the battles of Bull Run, Antietam, Gettysburg, Stone River, Vicksburg, Wilmington, and so on. This was a scenario, too, for a trance dream of his own death." In his papers, the late Lord Halifax left this account of Lincoln's promontory dream. Several years ago, Mr. Charles Dickens, as we know, went on a tour of America. Among other places, he visited Washington, where he called upon his friend, the late Mr. Charles Sumner, the well-known senator who was present at Lincoln's death. After talking of various matters, Mr. Sumner said to Dickens, "I hope that you have seen everybody and everything that you wanted to see, that there is no wish unfulfilled." "Well," replied Dickens, "there is one person whose acquaintance I greatly wish to make, and that is Mr. Stanton." "Oh, that is very easily arranged," Sumner assured him. "Mr. Stanton is a great friend of mine. Come and meet him here." So it was arranged, and much conversation passed. Towards midnight, before the three men separated, Stanton turned to Sumner and said, "I should like to tell Mr. Dickens that story about the president." "Well," says Sumner, "the time is very suitable." Stanton proceeded as follows. "During the war, as you know, I was in charge of all the troops in the District of Columbia, and as you may imagine, I had my hands pretty full. One day there was a council ordered for 2 o'clock, but I was pressed with business and could not get there till 20 minutes past. When I entered, most of my colleagues were looking rather grave, but I thought nothing of that, nor of the words that fell from the president as I entered. But the gentleman, this is not business. Here's Mr. Stanton. Business proceeded, and various matters were discussed and settled. When the council broke up, I walked away arm in arm with the Attorney General, saying to him as we left, "Well, we have really done some work today." The President applied himself to business, instead of flitting from one chair to another, talking to this and that man. "Ah," said the Attorney General, "but you were not here at the beginning. You do not know what passed." "What did pass?" I asked. "When we entered the council chamber today," resumed the Attorney General, "we found the President seated at the top of the table with his face buried between his hands. Presently he raised it, and we saw that he looked grave and worn. He said, 'Gentlemen, before long you will have important news.' We all inquired, 'What, sir, have you had bad news? Is it anything serious?' He replied, 'I have heard nothing. I have had no news. But you will hear tomorrow.' We again pressed him to tell us what had happened, and at last he said, 'I have had a dream. I have dreamt that dream three times. Once before the Battle of Bull Run, once on another occasion, and again last night. I am in a boat alone on a boundless ocean. I have no oars, no rudder. I am helpless. I drift, I drift, I drift.' 5 hours afterwards, the President was assassinated." Ford's Theater fell into disuse a few years after Lincoln's assassination. It remained abandoned for a century. In 1968, however, the Ford's Theater Society restored it as a working theater and as a museum of theatrical relics and of assassination souvenirs. Since its opening, many have experienced the local presence. In the main, the hauntings are in the form of sound and temperature changes, the sound of footsteps and the chilling of the atmosphere before certain enactments take place, like curtains raising and lowering of their own accord. One stagehand appears was so unnerved by the laughter of spook voices that he fled while changing to go home, finding himself minutes later in the street in his underpants. There is a uniqueness about the spook or spooks at Ford's Theater, for here is to be found the occult line. That line is the route Booth took making his escape. Actors and actresses standing on or near the route of the assassin's flight have often been afflicted in unusual and disturbing ways. Nausea, nervousness to the point of shuddering, and loss of memory. Some even forget where they are to an extent never before experienced in their careers. Both Hal Holbrooks and Jack Aronson have testified to the power of going near the occult line. The Spanish actor, Mondaguel de Mandela, was once taken to the then derelict theater by a friend to review the scene of Lincoln's assassination. During the visit, the friend begged to be excused. For a while, Mandela was left alone in the auditorium. Sitting himself in one of the dusty seats, the actor looked towards the fateful box. Ah, there was his friend again. No, it couldn't be. The friend could not have aged that much in a few minutes, nor have changed into a frock coat. Of course, too, the friend was clean-shaven. Mandela watched the figure sit down in the box and slump forward. A few seconds later, he heard a voice give a hoarse laugh and say, Mandela could speak no English, what sounded like a draft. In a moment, Mandela's friend returned and the actor explained what he had seen. It couldn't have been me, the friend said in Spanish. I was at the other side of the theater. Was a draft? In fact, I drift? Maybe the wraith of Abraham Lincoln making one of its appearances. Ford's Theater certainly has its fair share of occultism. Just after the assassination, Matthew Brady took a photograph of the empty theater, and the negative revealed a transparent figure standing inside the presidential box. Did Brady freeze for all time the ghost of Lincoln? Or maybe even Booth? Harry Houdini's Encounters. Harry Houdini, who passed away in 1926, was the son of a Hungarian rabbi, and he was born in Eirik Weiss in Appleton, Wisconsin. He called himself Houdini after the French magician Jean Robert Houdin. Houdini first attracted special notice as a conjurer by his handcuff escapes, which he claimed to have perfected When he was apprenticed to a locksmith, many times he had freed him jammed handcuffs as part of his daily work. Houdini's other escapes, on which his fame chiefly rested, were from prisons, baffling in every case the authorities who had challenged him. Mail bags, straitjackets, sometimes were suspended upside down, trunks and glass boxes. Several of the escapes were carried out under water. Even though many of his tricks depended upon specially prepared apparatus, the basis of Houdini's success in America, Britain, Europe, and Russia was a dexterity and boldness unmatched by his fellow illusionists. The American magician developed a keen interest in the occult and devoted a large amount of his time to uncovering the trick of fraudulent spiritualistic mediums, who for $2 a time entertained at house parties, theaters, and seance rooms. A Brother's Call. Although a professional skeptic, he insisted that he could duplicate all known phenomena of supernatural modern designation by natural methods. Houdini wanted to believe that ghosts exist and collected a large amount of data on psychic phenomena. On his death, a number of papers were found which contained notes on haunted theaters and strange ghostly events connected with the theatrical profession. One such was quoted by psychic investigator Ida Clyde Clark. Harry Keller was one of the most noted magicians of his time and was a great friend of Houdini's. By virtue of his remarkable skill, he was known to the fraternity of magicians as Dean Keller. He not only performed amazing feats himself, but he discovered and trained for the American theatrical circuit some of the best magicians of the day. Among his protégés were two brothers, Ling Luk and Yamadeva, and with these expert performers, he toured the world, including many of the theaters in which Houdini himself performed. When Harry Keller and his performers arrived in China, Ling Luk and Yamadeva were very happy. Though they had not a drop of Chinese blood in their veins, being Hungarian-born, they always appeared in Chinese costume, and all of their young lives they had wanted to see China. They were showing in Shanghai, and after the evening performance, they would wander about the city in search of adventure. Yamadeva was very fond of bowling and got into an exciting match one night with a sea captain. Yamadeva seized one of the largest balls and drove it down the alley with all his might, but no sooner had he delivered the ball than he gasped his side and moaned in pain. The next instant, he had crumpled to the floor. Half an hour later in a hospital, they told Ling Luk that Yamadeva was dead, that he had ruptured an artery in that last fierce drive of the ball. Harry Keller and his troop were leaving early next morning for their next engagement in Hong Kong. Keller did what he could do to console Ling Luk, and he set about making plans for the burial. But the boy said, "I cannot leave Yamadeva in Shanghai. If he stays, I stay." And they could not move him from his decision. To pacify the heartbroken boy, and in the hope that he would become reconciled to his loss after a few days, Keller decided to take Yamadeva's body to Hong Kong. But the Chinese had their own ideas about the bodies of the dead, and the captain of the steamer Kiva, upon which they had engaged passage, was not disposed to cooperate in the plan. However, he was finally persuaded, not by American eloquence, but by American money, to take the corpse of Yamadeva aboard. All day on the boat, Ling Luk was very sad. He would not talk, but stood at the rail and stared into the river. At midnight, he rushed into Keller's cabin, greatly excited. "My brother is not dead," he cried. "He is alive. He has whistled to me several times. The whistle no one knows. We always used it as a signal in our act. I tell you, Yamadeva is alive. Open the coffin, quick!" According to Houdini's story, which was told to him many times by Harry Keller, the whistle was several times repeated and was heard by all on board. Passengers and crew gathered around the weeping Ling Luk. Now and then he would suddenly become very quiet and raise his finger. A moment later they would hear the low, peculiar whistle. At first the captain refused to open the coffin, but when he heard the whistle he consented to investigate. It was midnight. The boat was moving swiftly and steadily. In great solemnity, the passengers and crew gathered round while the lid of the coffin was removed. Ling Luk's face was very pale and very calm. Someone held a light above the coffin, and he leaned over the still body and looked into the face of Yamadeva. There was no sign of life. When Ling Luk raised his head, he was pitiful to see. "I will never leave Hong Kong alive," he said. "My brother has called me to join him. I have always obeyed that call." The day after their arrival in Hong Kong, Ling Luk was taken seriously ill and was carried to the hospital. He underwent an operation and died under the knife. The two brothers were buried in Happy Valley, Hong Kong. The Ghost That Committed Murder. While playing in Washington, D.C., Houdini did some research into the stories of the city's two famous ghosts, the angry shade of Pierre L'Enfant, the city's designer who is said to walk the basement of the Capitol, and that of President Lincoln at the White House. During his walks with people, he came across a woman called Amy Irving, who made her name as an actress in a little repertory company that used to be on East Street Northwest. Amy Irving had married twice, Harry Colonna, who had died after the birth of their second child, and Arthur Gilman, a fellow actor. Gilman had little talent as an actor and less talent to look for other work. He was one of those actors who only find work at New Year or Halloween. For over 20 years, Gilman was a character actor in the small theater circuits of the West Coast, working in shows that needed a ghost, a murderer, an undertaker, or a sinister old uncle. It wasn't that he was outright ugly. It was just that he had an air of death about him, to such an extent that no one liked working with him. Between seasons, he was lucky if he got a week's engagement with a concert party. When Houdini met Amy Irving, Gilman had been dead for some years, killed in 1911, it was said, by a ghost. One particular Christmas, Gilman had been hired with a group of other entertainers to act and play at a party held by a government official in one of the larger houses in Georgetown. For a fee equal to a month's salary on the boards, Gilman acted at the party as a stooge for a conjurer, danced with spinster guests, and took part in a blood-curdling dramatic tale. Entertainers and guests mingled at supper time and sat around a huge log fire. Then came the moment when the door of the party room crashed open. Startled rather than frightened, all eyes turned to the door. There in the light of the flickering fire stood a tall man in a shimmering white suit, black opera mask, and cloak. What could be seen of the flesh of the face was of corpse-like hue. One or two of the girls squealed with terror, but for the most part the guests guffawed with laughter. The white-clad man waved his arms up and down several times, as if he were doing some trick, and advanced with long, gliding paces into the room. From his mouth he uttered a groaning noise that sent shivers down most spines. Who could he be? The host had a quick look around at his guests to see if one was missing. No, they were all there. What about the entertainers? He had employed five, and five were there eating their supper. No doubt the stranger was a gatecrasher. The host nodded to Arthur Gilman to find out who the stranger was. Gilman put down his plate and walked over to the figure. He was seen to say something, and suddenly he fell to the ground as if he had been poleaxed. Someone screamed, and to the amazement of all those present, the figure vanished, leaving only a pile of clothes. Gilman was dead. His skull had been fractured by a heavy blow. Houdini was fascinated by the story. It seemed to him a case of escape illusion par excellence. How had the stranger done it? He had to find out. The illusionist traced the name of the government official at whose house the party had taken place. The official, however, had died a year after the party, and the house had been sold. The present owners knew nothing about the story. Houdini researched more and found some of the people who had been at the party. Most could not help with his inquiries, but one lady, Gladys Pedler, was able to tell him of a strange conclusion to the affair. The police had been called in, but had been unable to make any arrest. Each guest had a perfect alibi, each other. Miss Pedler, however, knew the neighborhood well and could remember the previous owner of the house. Harry grew excited when he heard the name of the owner. George Hyman, one of America's most dexterous amateur illusionists. He had died in the house in 1907. Before he died, it was common knowledge that Hyman had gone funny. He became a recluse and was violent to anyone who came near him. Ultimately, he committed suicide by hanging himself from the staircase. "It was a shock to me, I can tell you," said Miss Pedler. "I knew George Hyman in the old days. He always wore a white, shiny suit and a mask when he went to entertain at church socials and the like. That was George Hyman, all right, standing there in the doorway. I went hot and cold all down my spine when I saw him. The pile of clothes left after he disappeared were certainly his. His sister later identified them. But on that night, George had been dead some 4 years." Puzzle it out how he might, Houdini could not come to a logical answer. There were no trap doors in either floor or ceiling, and no hidden lights or screens to cause illusion. The Arthur Gilman case was undoubtedly supernatural. The Shuffling Footsteps. This was not the only brush with the unknown Houdini had. One occurred during his last trip to Boston. The theater where he gave his performance was haunted, or so members of the staff told him. When the theater was being built, a workman mysteriously disappeared without collecting his wages. His lunchbox, cap, and coat were found hanging on a hook near that part of the building that became the stage. The workman seemed to have disappeared one lunch break without trace, and there was speculation that something sinister had happened to him that never came to light. The ghostly happenings at the Boston Theater, as it was once called, were centered on shuffling footsteps heard from the direction of the empty stage late at night by several members of the staff, including the theater manager. The footsteps, Houdini was told, were so frequent in their occurrence that people took little notice of them. Houdini reported the manager saying at the time, "There is simply no normal explanation for the noises. I have heard them on dozens of occasions while working late. I've had floorboards ripped up, plumbing checked, but nothing of a mechanical fault of nature has been discovered. To me, the noises sound as though someone is shuffling about across the stage. The first time I heard it, I was alone in the theater and thought it was a burglar. I got the cops in, but they found no one. Every time the noises occur, the windows and doors have been tightly shut." Has Harry Houdini himself returned? On October 31st, 1926, Harry Houdini died in the arms of his wife. And soon after, speculation was rife that the great illusionist would attempt to cheat death and appear himself in ghost form. Did Houdini make a final escape from the realm we call death? Did he successfully communicate with his wife using the spiritualistic medium Arthur Ford in a secret code? Most people are as skeptical as Houdini would have been himself. Mrs. Beatrice Houdini at first most definitely attested that a message had come through from her dead husband. She signed a statement to that effect and confirmed it in a letter to gossip columnist Walter Winchell on January 19, 1929. Later she began to wonder if the message actually were from Houdini, and she doubted right up to her death in 1934. Some, however, still think that Houdini's ghost is active. Take, for instance, the Palace Theater story. On a number of occasions, the ghost of a tightrope walker has been seen at the Palace Theater in New York. Some have even seen his spectral death fall and heard the cry of fear as he plummets to the ground. Peter Gray took some photographs of the place where the ghost was seen, and to his surprise, a negative showed a psychic extra, the head and shoulders of a man later identified as Harry Houdini. The puzzle is that the ghost at the palace only dates from the 1950s, a quarter of a century after Houdini's death. In fact, the ghost is thought to be of a vaudeville acrobat, Louis Borsellino, who was mortally injured here in the 1950s. Perhaps Houdini's ghost is not fussy as to whose psychic act he gets in on. Actor Richard Hughitt recorded a story about Jay Fox, the director and choreographer, who has also had contact with the shade of Houdini. It seems that Fox was preparing to mount a musical of the life of Harry Houdini, a project that was jinxed from the start by numerous problems. Investors reneged, actors left the cast, and at the last minute the script was the wrong length, and technical difficulties dogged the production. Eventually, the cast got into rehearsal at a small theater somewhere in the country. One day, when depression caused by setbacks was at its highest, someone suggested that they consult the fates using a Ouija board. The company did so, any suggestion from the other world being deemed welcome, and this message will receive. I'll send a sign. Gloom was lifted instantly at the thought of Houdini's spirit communicating directly. To advertise the show, it was decided to decorate the outside of the theater with strips of tinfoil. Huguette says that a gusty breeze came along almost from nowhere on that sunny day, and to the company's astonishment, the wafting lengths of tinfoil formed themselves into a large H. Harry Houdini, it was supposed, was trying to reassure them that all would be well. The opening performance of the musical took place at Stephanie Barber's house, Wheatley. Eyewitnesses say that during the performance, a trunk used for Houdini's escape suddenly acquired on its front a large H. It certainly had not been there before, and nobody had any idea who had painted it. The work of Houdini's ghost, it was said. What was Harry Houdini's favorite theatrical ghost story? Those who cleared out Houdini's papers on his death thought they knew. Penciled notes and newspaper cuttings were found to reveal a curious ghost murder story that Houdini was piecing together when he died. All the evidence was put together to form the following tale of mystery. Grandmother's Legacy. In bygone days, a favorite theater with Los Angeles playgoers was the Primrose, located near Hill Street. Here, the Primrose Theater Company put on plays for over 20 years. The company had been started by Arnold Gibson, grandfather of its most famous owner, Rosemary Primrose Adelaide Gibson Myers, whose family had fought in the Mexican War. As Miss Gibson, Rosemary Myers had cut a dash in vaudeville in New York and Washington. Around 1897, just about the time oil was struck in California and industry began to be developed, she took over the Los Angeles Theater from her father. Now long demolished, the Primrose Theater did not have an impressive frontage. In fact, it looked more like a large candy shop than a theater. At the top of those stairs leading to the small auditorium, theater-goers would often stop and admire an old clock. The case for the clock had been made to order for the Gibson family by Prudent Mallard in his Royal Street shop in New Orleans. The clock was of lemon wood and rosewood and stood on a fine pedestal. The old timepiece was Rosemary Myers' pride and joy. She wound it carefully every day. The sound of its penetrating, ratchety, creaking spring was a sign to other people in the theater that the old lady was going to bed, just as its loud morning strike announced to the staff that she was about to come down from her flat above the theater. Mrs. Myers always told her granddaughter, Shirley Ann, that the clock would be hers one day. Mrs. Myers had brought Shirley Ann up herself after the death of the girl's father and mother in an accident at sea. Shirley Ann was a precocious, arrogant, and conceited child, but Mrs. Myers saw in her some talent for the stage and expected to bequeath her the Primrose. In particular, she wished to see her granddaughter as fond of the old clock as she was herself. But Shirley Ann was not interested in acting and loathed the old clock. When Mrs. Myers sent her to New York to learn theater management, she neglected her training in favor of devoting herself to a young actor who had caught her fancy. His name was Leonard Banks. He refused to marry her, but she went to live with him in his apartment nevertheless. When her grandmother learned of this arrangement, she cut Shirley Ann out of her will and left the theater and its contents to her nephew instead. Some 6 months later, Rosemary Myers fell ill with a heart complaint and had a change of heart. Shirley Ann was sent for. "Have you married that horrid man?" Mrs. Myers asked her granddaughter. And when the girl answered, quite truthfully, "No," the old lady was pleased. "I hope you are remembering to wind the clock." "Oh, yes, grandmother." Shirley Ann, in fact, confronted the clock every day. As she opened the door of the clock and looked at the arrangement of pulleys, weights, and ropes, it reminded her of a stomach. The clock had a face, head, and hands. Somehow it was almost human with its pendular heartbeat. Because she hated it, the knowledge That she had power over the mechanism gave Shirley Anne a thrill. She had only to stop winding it, and the clock would die. That night, Shirley Anne overheard Mrs. Myers giving her servant instructions to go for her attorney, because I wished to alter my will. Next day, after the midday meal, the family lawyer came and went, and for an hour later, a messenger arrived with a sealed envelope for Mrs. Myers. Shirley Anne looked at it. It was the very shape and size of a new will. Happily, she watched it being taken into her grandmother's room. All was saved. But then she began to think. Suppose grandmother gets better. If she's changed her mind once, she could easily do it again. She did not precisely want her grandmother dead, but, well, she couldn't help remembering something Leonard had said as he saw her off for Los Angeles. Why don't you slip something in the old hag's medicine? And miraculously, opportunity presented itself, for the night nurse could not come the following evening, and no replacement was available. Shirley Anne volunteered to see her grandmother through the hours of darkness. That night, Shirley Anne gave her grandmother an overdose. As the old woman swallowed the medicine, she said, "I knew you were a good girl, Shirley Anne." And then she added, "I've signed the will. I put it away safe myself." Below in the theater foyer, the clock seemed to tick all the louder. As it ticked slowly towards 9:45, Mrs. Myers began to sink. Suddenly the silence of the old woman's bedroom was broken. "Shirley Anne, the will. I've cut out nephew Joseph. I've left the theater and all my money to you. After all that matters to me is that you are happy. Do what you will." Downstairs, the clock struck 10, and Mrs. Myers' head slumped on the pillow. Next morning, Shirley Anne visited the Gibson attorney. "Your grandmother did not say where the new will was placed?" Shirley Anne shook her head. "No, she just told me she'd signed it and put it away safe, but how did she do it? I don't know. She was bedfast. None of the nurses or theater staff knew anything about it." "Well," continued the attorney, "I know she signed it, but unfortunately, Miss Myers, the law demands that actual documents be produced, so the earlier will cannot be set aside until the new one is found." Leonard Banks came out from New York to help her look for the will and contest nephew Joseph's legacy. At the end of a fruitless day's searching, Shirley Anne noticed that the old clock in the foyer had stopped, exactly the moment of Mrs. Myers' death. At last the clock was dead as her grandmother. In a sense, she had murdered it too. In the case of the clock, however, the murder was easily undone. Shirley Anne felt a compulsion to prove that this was so. She wound the clock and set the pendulum a swing. The brass balance arced once or twice, but the clock stopped again. Once more Shirley Anne tried to start it, but it was like reanimating the dead. Leonard had a try, but he couldn't get it started either. "Stupid old clock," he gave it a shake. As he did so, the top of the pedestal split and collapsed with age. The heavy clock slid forward. There was a crash of weights, and the brass pendulum swung wildly. The whole thing fell on Shirley Anne and toppled her down the stairs onto the tiles of the foyer. Leonard Banks raced down the stairs. All his efforts to revive Shirley Anne were hopeless. She was dead, killed by the clock. It was some little time before Leonard, or the theater staff, who had quickly gathered, on hearing the noise, saw the long legal envelope lying in an angle on the stairs. It had been wedged under the clock, putting it off balance and preventing it from working properly. The envelope contained the will. The Gibson family attorney informed Leonard Banks, after the inquest on Shirley Anne's death, that the will had named Shirley Anne sole heir. As her husband, he could have had some claim on her estate. As her fiancé, he was entitled to nothing. A yellowing newspaper cutting can be added to the data on the Primrose Theater, Los Angeles. Dateline, Los Angeles. Earl Warburg reported. "The recent demolition of the Primrose Theater will stir the memories of older Los Angeles folks. In the late years, the theater, it was famous for its ghostly gray lady, who used to hover near an old clock at the top of the foyer steps.